All right, everybody. I've got a Game Trail podcast I'm recording today. I'm back from Wyoming. It's been a hot minute since I recorded an episode. I got a buddy that works for Go Hunt today that I asked to jump on to maybe help me understand how to kill an elk, because Dave killed a bull on a Utah limited entry tag this year, so I wanted to find out how his hunt went and just pick his brain. I'll give him a chance here to kind of introduce himself here in a sec, but Dave Barnett's my guest today. I'll jump in here in a sec, but before I get going, I need to hit you guys with a promo code. You guys can use the promo code GAMETRAIL if you sign up for a Go Hunt Insider account. Now's a good time to sign up, even though it feels like we're still kind of in the midst of hunting season. A lot of us that are mostly bow hunters, unfortunately, a lot of our seasons are kind of over for Western big game hunting. If you guys are whitetail hunting, you're just kind of moving towards the best part of your year. But if you're a Western big game hunter, you're looking into getting more opportunities to go hunting next fall, now's the time to kind of jump in and start planning. I know that the Big Hunt Guys episode that we recorded earlier on this week, Lorenzo and I covered some of the upcoming deadlines maybe that are approaching. So you've got that November 3rd deadline for Arizona OTC deer, which is coming up quick. Also, you've got that change in Idaho where they're going to a general season draw for non-residents. That draw is going to take place December 5th through the 15th. So that's approaching. So if you're not an insider, now's a great time to sign up. And if you use that promo code GAMETRAIL, you're going to get 50 points back in the Go Hunt Gear Shop, which is good for $50 that you can use towards the purchase of any gear that you want in the shop. Also, shout out Matthews Archery as a sponsor of my podcast. Those guys have been really good to me. I think it's okay. I say I've been playing with a new bow from them. I think guys are going to be stoked. I can't say probably any more than that. Even that is probably more than I should say. But, I mean, you guys kind of all know that in November, Matthews is going to launch, you know, a new bow or two. So, you know, it's going to be approaching. I think people are going to be stoked, myself included. So, thanks to those guys. With that, Dave, how you been?
Doing good, man. Doing great.
Doing good. I feel like we live in the same town. So for people that don't know, Dave and I actually live probably less than 2 miles apart, unless he's moved. But nope. He just lives across Highway 56 from me. He works in a little remote office that we have. I think you've got what, 3 or 4 people there that work in that office?
Yeah, currently we're down to 3. One of them just had a baby, Michaela, there. So, yeah, it's just a couple of us flying solo.
Yep. So we have a little remote office here in Cedar City. It's mostly our insider research team. What is it? How long have you been with Go Hunt, Dave? I was trying to remember today when I was kind of
prepared. It's been a bit. Actually, just 7 years now, like officially with Go Hunt. And then I like wrote for Go Hunt for about 3 years prior to that.
So 7, is that what you said? Man, time flies.
Yeah, yes, it does.
Yeah. Give us, what do you do here exactly? So I probably know from your signature what it is that your signature says on your email, but what is it that you actually do?
Yeah, I do a lot of different things. My official title is research content manager. So, I mean, largely at the end of the day, I'm dealing heavily in the insider platform. So season updates, new unit profiles, creating new states, that kind of a thing. But I dabble in a lot of things. I do a lot of things with maps, getting in the customer service side of things. You know, so I get to talk to a lot of people on different aspects for sure.
Mm-hmm. How much customer service do you do in a day? It's a lot.
Depends. Just depends on the time of the year. Sometimes it's a lot. Sometimes it's a little.
Yeah. You like it?
Yeah. It's different. I mean, it's customer service at the end of the day. It has its times, but it's cool getting to, connect with people, especially on the insider side of things, getting to hear back from people, after hunts or, as you're planning for hunts, it's cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I used to do a lot of that, via email. I still do a lot of it via DM now though.
So it's
just switched forms. So where I used to kind of do a lot of what Dave does now via, email that comes through our main accounts and kind of resolving customer service issues or just answering questions, it feels like it just is kind of switching out of my DMs, which is awesome. But I love that, to be honest. I actually feel bad that I don't necessarily always get back to people as timely as I might should. But I, And then when I did customer service for GoHunt, I actually really liked it. It was fun because you felt like mm-hmm. it was like something tangible, right? So like you're actually making connections with people. You're trying to help them solve a problem. You're trying to help them be more successful on a hunt, you know, and you always get those follow-up emails and messages from people that have found some success or, you know, had a good first experience or whatever it might be. But those are always my favorite, the comebacks. Actually, I kind of missed that. It was fun.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I enjoy it.
Yeah. Where are you from originally?
I'm originally from Western Montana. I grew up there, a little bit of time in Northern Idaho, within like an hour circle, but, so primarily all up north and then moved down to Utah here, 7 years ago. And I went full time with GoHunt.
Do you miss Montana?
Parts of it, it's different, you know, than Utah, obviously. But we like a lot of the stuff we have in Utah, but I think the biggest issue I run into now is like, what I remember Montana as being like, it's not that anymore. You know, things have changed so drastically, and it's just, I mean, Montana always have a place in my heart for sure. But yeah, right now Utah is just, with us being in kind of the kids and family stage, mm-hmm. You know, we really like what we have here.
How I'm curious, how's Montana changed in your opinion?
Just a lot of the small town charm has kind of disappeared in areas, or like you've seen just like a large separation of just like not necessarily living conditions, but the ability to cut a living in some of these areas. You know, it got a lot harder in some of the small towns, but it's just, yeah, a lot of the charm of Montana has changed from, you know, from what I grew up with, just in largely just with the influx of people, which I think is just kind of a testament of how great Montana is. You know, there's so many people wanting to go there. You know, but yeah, it's different for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. It's relative too, right? Cause I kind of feel the same way about Utah. I mean, I grew up in Southern Utah in a super small town and, you know, in a lot of ways we still live, I mean, you live in Cedar too. It's not a big town by any means, maybe 5,000 people. I don't know. But, you know, sometimes I think about the way that I grew up. I feel like, you know, my three boys are getting older and I feel like maybe I've done them somewhat of a disservice by raising them where I have in comparison to the upbringing that I got to enjoy, which is really rural. But yeah, I look back on it and it's like this. Yeah. I miss the nostalgia. Do you know what I mean? I miss the small town. And I don't know. I when I say that, it sounds, I feel like an old fuddy-duddy, right? I'm like, oh, I'm one of those guys. Like I'm middle-aged now at this point, like, you know, middle-aged people were when I was a kid and they look back and they're like, man, the good old days, that was when it was great.
yeah.
From a hunting perspective, do you think Montana's changed much?
No, I think there's opportunity there. I mean, you know, things like continue to kind of struggle. I mean, mule deer in the northern part of the U.S. have just, you know, had to struggle for the past few years for sure. You know, but I think a lot of it, like looking back historically, I mean, you look at like Western Montana, like just the sheer number of elk that used to be there, you know, prior to, you know, a lot of changes. I mean, and it was huge, but they were almost like, it was like more than like it could support. I mean, it was bonkers. You know, I think Montana is a good state for somebody that just wants to get in and work hard. You know, there's definite potential there, but it's a state you have to work hard to find it in. But yeah, I think it's a great state from a, you know, from a general hunting aspect.
Yeah. I know the people that I know, and there's certainly a lot of people within our space that, you know, live, work in Montana. It feels like every year, you know, I watch those guys on social media pretty closely and, you know, it feels like they're constantly, you know, in animals and they're hunting good, especially when in regards to elk, feels like they're, you know, taking nice bulls every year and they're hunting. There's a part of me that's like, man, you know, what if?
Oh, yeah. Well, and like with just tag availability as a resident, I mean, you have essentially 11 weeks you can hunt on your OTC tag. So it's like you have the ability to like really start learning some areas. And yeah, I mean, in general, you know, talking about bulls, there's states you could probably kill bigger bulls, you know, more often. And even some draw states, you know, you're talking tags you could drive a couple of years. But like just having the ability to hunt the same stuff over and over and over again in Montana, like you start getting so, you know, dialed. And like, yeah, there's some guys that, I mean, you look at guys that are killers in Montana and they routinely kill, you know, big stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I envy, I should say, is maybe that's the word. I envy, you know, people's ability that live in a state like Montana or Wyoming to buy an over-the-counter permit, have the opportunity to hunt branch antler bulls or bucks every single year. and kind of, you know, get to know an area and like really dive into it year after year, year after year, and really figure it out. I envy that. And it's not impossible. It's non-resident. It's just a lot harder.
Totally. Yeah. And I mean, like I took advantage of it for sure when I was there, but like, I definitely realized like after moving back out of Montana, like how valuable that general resident tag is, you know, just like mm-hmm. state of Wyoming. I mean, yeah, there's just a lot of potential with that tag, and there's like so many different ways, like you can hunt Montana. You know, there's so many different terrain types. So, yeah, I mean, you can kind of do whatever you want there.
Yeah. Since you have a background in history with Montana and you're a research mm-hmm. guy, as far as our draws and, you know, the systems and how they work. I had a couple questions actually. So I had a guy reach out today actually, and he was like, "Hey, I'm interested in drawing a Montana general season elk tag." And I'm leading the witness. I know the answer to this, but I think it'd be good to cover. He was wondering if you can hunt any and all general season units if you draw that permit, or do you have to pick units or a unit?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, that's kind of the beauty with Montana. Like as it is currently, if you have the general tag, you can hunt any general unit that's available. Now there are some caveats you have to watch. Like some units may have a general season that's only open for say like cows or spikes. You can't kill a branch bull on that, or you know, maybe some units might only have a general rifle season, but they don't have an archer season. So you know, you have to watch things there. But yeah, I mean, really at the end of the day, you could go from the far east side of the state to the far west on that OTC tag. So you have a lot of flexibility in balancing.
Yeah. The other question I would have for you in regard to Montana, and this is even one for me that's like still, every freaking year I have to dive in and like mm-hmm. reread it.
Right.
And reread it and reread it. And I just barely went through this process because I went back through and I, you know, purchased my bonus point. So bonus point, that period closed September 30th, I believe, right?
Yeah, correct.
Okay. So I bought my bonus point for elk, bought a bonus point for antelope for the 900, I guess, because mm-hmm. I thought maybe I'm starting to become more and more infatuated with antelopes. So I figured, well, yeah, I'm not, right? I might actually drive to Montana to hunt an antelope, which I would
right. have.
So I bought those two, but then your preference point purchase time frame is still open, right?
Yeah, so that runs to the end of the year.
Okay, so talk me through preference point in Montana, mm-hmm. what it applies yeah. to. Would you buy one? Should you buy one? Should you not buy one? And how that whole system works.
Totally. Yeah, this is like hands down, this is the number one question I get every year, like come app season, it's always Montana. And like at the end of the day, Montana has a really simple point system, but it's so convoluted with just weird rules that like, yeah, it's chaos. So basically your preference points, those are used to draw your combination licenses in Montana. So you got a non-resident, you have a combination deer, which is just a deer tag. You have your combination elk, which is just the elk tag, or you have the combo, which is deer and elk. So you have three different options you can use. It's one preference point that is applicable to all three tag choices. They're no separate there. So basically now how the system runs is 75% of the tags are going to be guaranteed to your highest point holders. So real similar like the Wyoming system. And the remaining 25% are going to be drawn random. But the weird caveat to that remaining 25% is that they're only made available to people with 0 points. So you run into this weird situation right now where in most cases, the people at say the 1 point level, like don't have enough points to draw any of the 75% of the tags, but because they have 1 point, they're now nullified from that 25% of the tags that go to the 0 point holders. So you end up in a weird situation where you have, you know, a marginal odd at 0 points, and then you have a 0% odd at 1 point, and then it back up again. So there's like some weirdness to that. Now, the other thing you run into is Montana is very, very stringent with preference point purchase. And the main caveat on there is if you buy a preference point this year and then you don't apply next year, the state's going to take that point away from you. Mm-hmm. So hypothetical in that situation, you've purchased your point right now for 2025. We hit our application period for 2026 and you don't apply. You now have zero preference points again. So the state removed that point from you.
So if I bought one, right? So if I bought a mm-hmm. preference point for elk and I go into this draw, this coming draw mm-hmm. for 2026, which is usually in the spring, mm-hmm. I don't apply, they'll purge my point that I just bought a week ago or whatever.
Correct. Yeah, correct. Yeah, it's wild. Yeah, so you really got to pay attention to that. So generally, like, my recommendation is if you're going to go the point route, you know, purchase your point the year before you're going to apply. And then when you go into the draw, this is kind of another caveat with Montana that's interesting. Montana allows you to purchase points when you submit your application, and those points will apply to that application.
So if I understand that right, if I just purchased a point in September, I purchased a preference point, right? And I apply in the spring, I have the option to purchase a preference point again, essentially?
Yeah, correct.
So would I go into the draw with two preference points?
Yeah, you would. Okay. So in that instance, that's putting you in pretty good shape for drawing the tag. Say if you're looking at the elk combo or the big game combo, you have 0% odds at 1 point. So if you go into that draw with 1 point, you're not going to draw the tag. You go into two, you got a pretty good shot, 80% or better. Now, as far as like kind of your draw strategy with that tag, now essentially there's like two different routes you can go for. So one route is applying for the draw and going for 0 points. So not purchasing your point when you apply and going into the draw with 0 points and trying to score on one of those 25% of the random tag. That has been dropping, but generally, you know, plus or minus 50% odd of going that route.
Did you say 15 or 50?
50-0.
Okay.
Now the issue with going that route is if you don't draw your tag, so you apply to 0 points, you didn't draw your tag, because you participated in that draw already, Montana is not going to let you build a preference point this year now. So your only opportunity, if you apply, is to buy your point when you apply. Mm-hmm. Now, the other side of that, if you have 0 points and you go to apply and you decide to purchase your point when you apply, you're going to go into the draw with 1 point and you have 0% chance of drawing.
Yeah.
You know, so if you're a person that's just looking to build a point, you don't want to go that route because you're paying your app fees, you're paying your base hunting license, conservation, et cetera. There's a lot of prerequisites you have to do that. If you're just going to build a point, you can purchase the point later in the year. It runs from July 1 to December 31, and it's $100. You don't have to do any of the prerequisite stuff, so it's cheaper going that way. But yeah, so going back to your abstracts, yeah, if you go in at 0 points and you don't draw, you're restarting next year at the 0 point pool again.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a gamble you make. On the point side of things, basically it's another $200. You're going to buy a point this year for $100, and then you're going to buy a point next year when you apply for another $100, go into the draw of 2 points. In the off chance that you don't draw at 2 points, you'll go in next year, you know, up to 3 points, you'll 100% draw guaranteed at three.
Right. And then, so that's what I did. So I bought a preference point. I didn't have any preference points because I'd planned on applying last year and didn't. And so my points were purged.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't have any points. I bought the preference point. My plan was to apply. Purchase the preference point when I apply, assuming that I would go into the draw with 2 points. And the reason I did that is because I'm not really interested in a general season permit, to be honest. I'm more interested in the special limited quota permit, if you will, right? Mm-hmm. So that's like another part of the Montana's whole draw system is in order to be in the draw for the special limited quota permit, say that's like a, you know, Missouri breaks tag, right? You have to draw first the general season combo before your application is even considered, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I figured my best chance to draw the general season combo was to buy a point when I apply, hopefully draw that, and then at least my my application would be considered. So that's kind of what I'm hoping. But man, I wish they'd make it easier on folks.
Oh, it's so tough. Yeah. So that's the other thing with the limited entry thing now. Those run on bonus points, which cool thing on bonus points is they don't expire. So you can buy those, they don't expire. And same caveat applies to those during the draw when you submit your app. You can pay your bonus point fee. That point will get applied to your app for this year. You know, so you kind of get a little bonus going in, if you will. The limited entry tags, you have to first draw your general tag to get the limited entry. And then you run into issues where, say, if you're a guy that's like, I'm only going to hunt a limited entry tag, it's the only tag I'm going to hunt Montana. Like, draw that general. Yeah. You draw your general tag and then you're unsuccessful in drawing your limited entry tag. Now you got to return that general tag at an 80% refund. Plus you lost your 2 points. And yes, it's just, Montana is not an easy state to plan on from like a trophy aspect in that regard. But yeah, generally speaking, some of those limited entry tags are you can count on drawing them, with fairly high level of confidence. You don't guarantee draw tags in Montana. It's all random, but yeah, you get enough bonus points built up and then get your preference points situated and try to apply in one go. And then if you're unsuccessful, you're trying again in 2 years.
Yeah, I think I've got the points to draw the special limited quota permit, right? And like you said, it's not a guarantee, it's still a random draw. I just have more names in the hat, if you will, based on the number of bonus points that I've got. So I think I draw that, but I tell you what, I'm going to be irked if I don't.
Oh,
I
man.
lose my two preference points and I'm shelling out. I would have shelled out $200 for the 2 points, plus I would have shelled out whatever 20% of
Yeah,
the
you're another
combo
couple
is.
hundred.
Yeah, 400. So I'll be into that 400 and some dollars, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, which is a real kick in the teeth, but it is what it is. Yeah, I mean, if you want to hunt elk, I guess it's just the nature of the beast. But
Right.
no, I appreciate it. Do you still apply in Montana?
I'm actually going back this year just for deer. I've been buying points up there, but just since I moved down here, I've just been like kind of going hog wild, exploring stuff, that I've never done before. But yeah, I'm still buying points in Montana. I have plans to go back. It kind of makes me sick now, like looking at like my moose, sheep, goat points as a non-resident. Like as a resident, I was in the chips on pretty much everything right now. But so yeah, that's tough. But yeah, I am going to go back this year, but I haven't went there since we moved.
Yeah. Do you still buy points for moose, sheep, goat up there?
I do. I mean, it's always a long shot on the non-res side, but in the off chance that I did end up moving back to Montana, I think it's been real nice.
I think that's a good point. Yeah, you never know. You might move back home, right, at some point in the future, and maybe you want to retire back in Montana, and it would sure be nice to be sitting on 30 points or something at that point.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, I think about that quite a bit. Yeah, so like Wyoming's a great example. Like I quit buying points for moose and sheep up there just because the juice wasn't worth the squeeze, and there just
Right.
weren't, especially the last few years where they're not really even given bonus point or preference point permits to non-residents. It's random, and then they don't really increase your odds with the number of preference points you have up there, right? So it's
No.
like, what's the point of buying them? But then, I started applying in Wyoming in my early 20s, and I'm in my mid 40s now, and I think, man, if I'd have bought a point every single year, and then maybe when I'm 60 or 65, if I move to Wyoming, those might be worth something at this
Right.
stage in the game. So I'm a little bit kicking myself in the butt for not having continued to play the game. But I know money isn't an endless thing either. Yeah, you only have so much, right?
Right.
I appreciate you. So where else do you? I know you applied in Utah. We want to get into that, but you've been a resident of Utah. Maybe we'll just dive into it. So you drew an elk tag this year, right?
Yeah, so drew the elk tag. This is actually my last year on dedicated hunter, and I'm out of tags. So I'm sitting out on deer hunting in Utah this year. But yeah, actually, kind of a fairly light year. I was mostly just building points. I'm getting set up over the next couple of years. I'm gonna have quite a few hunts kind of lined out. So yeah, this year just pretty much Utah elk, some family hunts, and then Montana deer.
How many points did you have? And did you have max points, or did you draw a random permit?
I drew on random. I was just under the point break. I knew I'd get the tag in the next few years. But yeah, I did draw on the random.
Gotcha. How'd you decide on the unit that you applied for?
Honestly, I just kind of took a realistic look at things. I was building points here in Utah for limited entry elk. And honestly, I was just kind of tired of waiting. And I didn't have a lot of points, but growing up and kind of cutting my teeth in elk hunting in northern Idaho and western Montana, I mean, number one, like elk hunting was like a meat getting mission for us. So it was like the only time you ever killed something big was because like that was the first animal that got in front of you. So like elk has always been like a big passion of mine, but it's also always been just like a meat thing. We hunt just kind of hunted for meat. So like with that, like I've killed nice bulls, but I've never killed anything like big. But yeah, so like this year coming to NAFC season, I really started looking at things, and I think like the biggest thing for me was like a 300 inch bull to me is big, and like I'm happy with that. And I like very much so, especially like in the past few years, like getting older, like the experience is a lot more important to me, and like how, you know, everything kind of goes about than like the animal I'm hunting per se. So yeah, found a unit that I liked, and you know, on paper in Utah, not a great unit, you know, for big bulls, but like coming from like general elk hunts that I'm used to, it was a phenomenal hunt. And I was just thinking about it, and I was like, damn, you know, I could do this hunt a few times, you know, in the amount of time it took me to draw one of these better tags. And like, yeah, I have a better chance at a bigger bull, but like, I'm the type of guy, if I could have like a couple of like 320 bulls or even one 320 bull and then just a garage full of raghorns, like I'd die a happy elk hunter with that. Right. You know, so I was like, yeah, I just want to have a good time. You know, like, yeah, like I said, archery elk hunting was like kind of my thing growing up, and like particularly like me and my dad, like that's like what we bonded on. It was like kind of like a lot of our relationship is built on archery elk hunting, and he was diagnosed with the disease several years ago. He's been around longer than he should be based on averages with that. So like time is limited, you know, we've been trying to, it's kind of a weird thing. We've done a lot of last hunts over the past few years, and it's like kind of like a weird, like emotional thing to go through. It's just like, you know, he keeps on kicking and he's doing great and it's awesome, but it's always like, it's kind of a weird thing. Like, you know, that it's like one of your last hunts, but like, you don't know if it is. You know, so like getting to experience like a really good archery elk hunt with my dad was like an important thing that I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. You know, so yeah, put in for the hunt, ended up drawing, which was awesome. I was stoked. You know, and then kind of just started diving into e-scouting on the unit. You know, I felt good. I mean, I feel very confident in my e-scouting, like locating elk. And it's just the unit kind of had everything that I like in an elk hunt. I'm not much of a backcountry guy for elk. I really kind of like stick into like just fast elk hunting in like kind of pressured areas and finding pockets and jumping and moving. And that's kind of like my forte, if you will. That's what I like. You know, and this unit was real conducive to that.
Yeah. Which is, it's interesting. It's been highlighted more to me in the last couple of years than, you know, ever before, in that style of hunting is as much a skill as anything. Like the individual that can, you know, feel comfortable, for one, you know, like hunting in and around other people and roads and trails and hearing other, you know, other people bugle. You know, I was just in Wyoming and got my butt kicked, and, you know, I was talking to some guys and they were like, man, we've heard all kinds of bugles, you know? And I'm like, man, I haven't heard hardly any bugles. And, you know, these guys were like, man, we're hearing them all over. And I was like, well, how many of them are you hearing are hunters? And they were like, I don't know. We just kind of chasing bugles, you know. It was like they hadn't even really, and I put way too much weight in it. Like I would hear, I would hear a bull bugle, and, you know, I would sit there for 5 or 10 minutes going, yeah, what's the likelihood that that's a bull?
Right.
I don't really want to go march through a bunch of down and deadfall and get over there and just run into some other people. And I was like, man, it didn't really sound that convincing. So there were a lot of elk that I let bugle, and I turned and walked away from them, not knowing fully whether it was a bull or a person, you know, but assuming it was a person just because, you know. But that in itself is a skill, and it's one that I lack. Like, I'm not a good, you know, our camera guy will tell you, like our interactions, we'd run into people out there and we'd have a little exchange with them, talk with them about their plan and what they're doing and whatnot. And, you know, they would move on. And then our camera guy would be like, man, you look completely deflated. And I would be like, yeah, I am. Like I would run into somebody and I'd be like, shit, I hate that. You know what I mean? I'm not good at it. I don't know how to deal with it always. You know what I mean? And so that in itself is a skill, and there are people that are definitely good at it. So I think it's cool that you're like, that's your style and you're comfortable with it. And there's a bunch of elk that are not all that far from a road. And if you can come proficient at that, I mean, you can do really well.
Yeah, totally. And that's where, like, I mean, like I said, I'm not a big bull killer, but like I feel quite a few elk tags, and most of my elk are usually mile and a half to 2 miles off the road. You know, they're pretty close. And I think, like, for me, kind of the big kick on that was like struggling with like a unit that has like amazing habitat throughout the unit, right? So like I would be always like, okay, I got to find the X where the elk are, you know, so I'm trying to figure out where all that is in the sea of habitat. And at the end of the day, like you're kind of ending up in the same like little like roadless sections, you know, that look good. And a lot of people are hitting those too. And for me, like the big change was instead of looking at those units and being like, okay, I got to figure out where the elk are, the easiest thing was being figuring out where people are, because I think they're a lot more predictable. And then just kind of realizing the fact that like elk really don't care where they live as long as their needs are met, and they're going to do whatever they can to avoid people, you know, so usually they end up in just shitty spots. You know, so I would just go through and just look at spots that, you know, meet the criteria for elk, your typical, you know, just north facing, whatever. You know, but look for like the small holes the guys are gonna be driving around. They're not really hitting you. Maybe you gotta cross a creek and get into the spot or something. And then yeah, it's like I find a lot of elk like that.
Yeah. Is your dad, does he live here in Utah now, or does he still live in Montana?
He lives in Idaho, northern Idaho.
Gotcha. And that's cool that he was able to come down and hunt with you.
Yeah, it was so awesome, man. And like, yeah, so I mean, leading up to the hunt, like I put so much more pressure on myself than I needed to. And like, I had just like, it was like, I had so many little buckets or like experiences that I wanted to get. Like at the end of the day, like I wanted my dad calling a bull for me to kill, you know, and there's like all these things, you know, so yeah, I mean, there was, you know, things rolled out different than I was expecting, but at the end they turned out how I wanted them to. But yeah, it was very cool getting shit out of my dad.
Yeah. So with that hunt opening in August, did you go out in August, or how did you end up landing on the dates?
Yeah.
When did you?
So I actually did not go out in August, which I know like limited entry tag. People are like, why the hell weren't you out there? So like I went up in July with my wife and kids. Like, so for us, like during the summer, like we bought a camper a few years ago. Like we camp every weekend. Like that's our big thing. So we took a long trip, took the kids up there, pulled the camper up, spent the weekend. And mostly then, I mean, like, obviously I was looking for elk, but I was just kind of ground checking stuff, driving roads, you know, seeing access stuff. And just cause like things always look way different in, you know, in person than they do on the computer. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we did that. And then, yeah, so I did have plans to go up opening weekend. My idea was just to get up there, just kind of cover ground, not necessarily try to kill anything, but just see what was there. And honestly, my biggest worry was that I was going to kill a bull without my dad there. So I decided not to. So we waited. We got up there, I think it was the second or third. It was the last few days before the spike hunt ended when we got up there. Mm-hmm. You know, so I ended up killing my bull on the eighth or ninth, something like that. But yeah, so we got up there kind of the second half of season, if you will.
Gotcha. So what was your, I mean, everybody, I know we did a podcast about it, but everybody supposedly this year, you know, was going to be the most epic elk rut of all time on the 20th, you know, with the Equinox, mm-hmm. and kind of landing with perfect, you know, rut timing. And for me, certainly it did not pan out to that.
Right.
I've had tons of messages, and I would say probably 80% of the people I've talked to kind of had a real similar experience that I did. And that's from Arizona, you know, Colorado, Wyoming, Montana. I mean, certainly there were pockets that got hot, but it's really had me down rabbit holes trying to understand exactly what happened this year in regards to the rut. And I'd love to be able to better predict that in the future.
Right.
So I've been down rabbit holes, but the full moon was on a 7th.
Mm-hmm.
So, which, you know, you would say the 7th of September, you know, through most of the Western United States, it's going to be warm. You have a full moon this year. You know, maybe the elk will be bugling a little bit, but if they are, they're going to be at nighttime. So I'm interested in what your experience was in regards to the rut this year.
Yeah, totally. The Utah archery season is just interesting just because like it ends early. So like, you look at like a typical archery hunt, you know, it's kind of interesting, but yeah, I mean, when we first got there, like bulls were talking, but they were pretty timid. Like, you know, if you tried to do anything, you know, they weren't into that at all. The last probably 3 or 4 days of the hunts, we started getting some bulls that were getting worked up, you know, bulls that were working each other up, you know, moving in and, you know, started getting a little calling, you know, opportunities. But I mean, they were still a little timid. But I mean, you know, honestly, we heard way more bugling than I was expecting. You know, we got into bulls every day, heard bugling every day, like good calling activity every day. And it was pretty, I mean, with the full moon, like kind of a funny like story. I completely forgot all batteries for headlamps. I had like one set of batteries for a headlamp for the whole trip. And like, we were far enough out. I mean, we could have gone there to town, but it was like an hour drive or whatever. But with the moon so bright, like we never used headlamps the entire trip. But even with the full moon, like it was pretty predictable. Like we'd get like bugling for like an hour in the morning, and then like midday, 11 to 2, like they'd start teeing off pretty hard again. And then they'd get up, you know, that last hour. But it was like, it was kind of the same thing every day. And it was enough that like we really never had like midday naps, you know, like a mountain nap that you get on an elk and on this hunt. It was just like, it was steady enough. And there was enough bulls that like, you know, we'd get a bugle going and check on one. And if he wasn't big enough or we blew him up or whatever, we'd turn and, you know, go after another bull that we had talking to.
Gotcha.
It was good.
Do you have a date that was like, man, it was really, really rolling. Like it was hot and heavy.
No, I wouldn't say we ever got anything like real, real crazy. And like most of the herds that we got into, you'd have like maybe one other bull, you know, kind of there, you know, but there was nothing, we never got anything like, you know, real wild, like you're really, really hoping for, you know, but yeah, we got a few, the bull that I killed, he was pretty worked up, but yeah, nothing too crazy.
Yeah. Take me through. Yeah. Do you have any close calls prior to that?
Yeah, dude, it was fun, man. So we had, the first day we got there, made a big loop into this area that I e-scouted, got into a bugle right away at first light, and ended up running down after him and very timid. I did a locator bugle out in this one spot. We kind of lost him. I did a locator and like 5 minutes later, we were cruising on this trail. He responded like within 150 yards, like real close. He just let one out. And yeah, as soon as we tried working on that bull, like he left immediately, like he wasn't having it. And then the second day we ended up getting into a bull that was bugling, kind of worked in, ended up calling him in. He was a small 5-point. He pushed a cow right by me at like 10 yards, which was like, it was like the biggest bull I ever passed on. I mean, he was like a 250 inch five or whatever, you know, but like it felt good. Like, I mean, it felt like we were doing things right. You know, like it was cool. He actually had another bull with him, and we ended up getting back on them like a few hours later and called that same 5-point in again. But never did get a look at the other bull. And that night it opened up and just dumped on us. And it was like one of those things where like things were good and we left the truck, like we didn't have much gear. We were like 2 miles from the truck and it just opened up and it like we just got annihilated. It was awful. We had a couple more instances. There was this one like wallow and there was a big crossing right at it, the bottom of his drainage. And we ended up after like a few days of hunting this area, kind of got these elk herds patterned. And I think it was more so like, it was like a lead cow kind of pattern. Cause it would be like different bulls each day, but kind of the same cow group. And I ended up following a nice 6-point, like 300-inch 6-point down in there one morning. Had him like at 60 and like almost got a shot. It's one of those things, you know, he just needed a few more seconds. He got into the trees and I bailed into the trees around him and like had cows and spikes coming by on this 30 yards broadside, like money. And he was just above him, you know, just kind of a typical bull thing. Mm-hmm. Several close encounters. I got on a nice 7-point one day, stalking him and the wind just swirled on us. Wind was brutal the whole trip, really swirly. Had a lot of like just close encounters on bulls, but a lot of it was fairly open country. It's aspen country, but there's a lot of like low growth aspen that makes it thick too, you know, so like at a head level you can see a long ways, but getting shots is tough at times. It just kind of every day was, you know, get up, get bugles, get on them, see what they are, you know, just kind of just keep checking herds, you know. So yeah, we got in tight on a lot of elk, you know, probably find the shot one.
Nice. Yeah, that's fun. That's the way an elk hunt should be, you know, just in, like every day's a new adventure, right? You're in elk. That's why those limited entry tags are so fun. It's interesting. Like I've had three, in Utah. Everybody I've talked to, I always tell them like, it's still elk hunting. Like it's still really hard, you know, it's just, the elk are there, you know, and some years they bugle pretty good and some years they don't. But it's still, even on a limited entry tag, I mean, it's still elk hunting. Like you still have to get after it, but it is fun every day. It's like that pick your own adventure. You know, you hear a bull bugle and you're just going to sound like which one sounds the best. I'm just gonna
and see what happens. That's cool. Totally. Yeah. We were still averaging like 7 to 8 miles a day. Right. You know, but it was nice up there. Cause like our elevation gain would be like 500 to 600 total, you know, at most. Really? So it was like, you covered a lot of ground and it was like, And the elk too, I mean, like they would, you know, they'd bump like three or four drainages between feeding and bedding at times. Like, you know, it's just kind of an interesting land. It was fun, you know, just to cruise through there, you know, be able to cover so much ground.
Were you running into a lot of people, Spike? I mean, I guess you waited until the spike hunt ended. Mm-hmm. So that would have, those hunters wouldn't have been in the field. Were you running into like people recreating, deer hunters, anything like
yeah,
that?
Yeah. So yeah, I didn't run into a single hunter in the field at all the entire trip. Never ran into one person. The weekends though, like it got rowdy with like recreational people, you know, side by sides. But we were pretty close to a lake, so there's boats and stuff. Like I remember like one night, like I had to get up at, like 2 a.m. take a leak, like couldn't make it, and like went outside and like I thought like I heard a, it was kind of windy, thought like I heard a bugle or something, and like finally like, you know, came to my senses and it's like Jason Aldean like blasting off this camper out in the, you know, way out in the meadow, and I'm like, oh shit, like you guys are partying, like, you know, so it, like there was a lot of sheep up there, so there's like sheep dogs, you know, those big newbies running around barking and stuff. So it was like, it was an interesting concept to be, I mean, we were like 20-30 miles, you know, from like the closest town. Like it was weird to be like so far from the closest town, but it was like a town was still up there and around you at times. It was kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. But yeah, as far as hunting pressure, we didn't run into nobody.
Yeah, take us through the bull that you killed. How'd that work out?
Yeah, it started out, this whole hunt had a lot of like weird setbacks, and I like kind of had like a weird feeling like in the middle of the hunt that I was like, okay, like I laid out in my head like kind of a mental checklist of like what I wanted out of this hunt. Here's the experiences I wanted. And like in a weird way, I feel like the universe was like, okay, but here's the crap you're gonna have to go through to get it. So like there's like a just a bunch of like just kind of weird setbacks on this hunt, and like it came like kind of clear to me that it was like, okay, you just got to keep dealing with these and just keep getting up, keep doing it. Like something's going to happen. Like we're getting so close every day, like it's going to happen. So yeah, this big wallow crossing that I mentioned, we kind of got a pattern out. Like elk are hitting this every single morning. They're crossing in the same spot. They're bugling their way all the way in. Like you would see them go to get set up and wait. And we get down into this spot, like before daylight, like everything's good. Bulls are up on top bugling right where they're supposed to be. Like everything's good. We can hear elk moving around above us. Like everything's coming in. And then all of a sudden this sheep, we can hear some sheep way off. And this one just starts screaming and like, just, I mean, just blood curdling. And then like all goes silent. And then coyotes start yipping like crazy. So coyotes like kill the sheep, like, I don't know, 300-400 yards down the drainage from us. Yeah. Like it was gnarly. And then all of a sudden you can hear the newfies come running in barking. I mean, like it was just chaos. And like the elk are kind of bugling, but I mean, you know, they're tapering off or whatever. So things kind of start getting scattered, and then the wind starts getting real crappy, and we got like elk kind of coming into the crossing, and they bump off, and then finally a bull comes in, and like not a bull that I want, and like my nerves just got a hold of me, and like he started spooking, and he turned around, and I freaked out and took a shot, and like totally whiffed the shot, like should not have whiffed it, and I did for a good reason, like just totally blew the shot. And like, I wasn't upset that I didn't kill that bull. Cause like immediately I was like, why did I shoot at that bull? Like, I wasn't happy with him. And I just like, I tried to force it. And like, I was honestly more upset. So like every trip that I go on, I have my kids like write something on the bank or like on the bullet casing. And it's like my good luck thing. And like, I tainted that arrow by shooting at that bull. Like I was pissed. And like, so we like went up there, found the arrow. I unscrewed the broadhead, like the arrow was fine, threw a new broadhead on and like popped it back in number one. Like, so, you know, we're good to go. But so like kind of a crappy morning, elk are totally scattered now. Like I missed a bull, like our plans are shot. So we go back to the camper and like, I was being a baby. Like I was feeling bad for myself and, you know, got a little snack and I was like, all right, like we got to go back out. I'm like, there's still a lot of elk here. I know they're here. So we have this new spot we want to go check out. We take a rip up there and somebody's parked there. And I'm like, okay, of course. Like, you know, this is how it's going. And I'm like, whatever, let's just go check the drainage like adjacent to where we just were. So we run the truck in there, he parked. And by now it's, I don't know, it was like, probably, I think it was like 12 or 1 o'clock, somewhere around there, like mid-afternoon. We start heading in, we're like 100 yards from the truck and a bull cracks off the head end of the base. And like, shit, here we go. So we like kind of keep working our way in there. We end up running into a group of cows with no bull with them. And the whole time, like this bull is bugling up in this head end. And he's kind of like on a saddle between two drainages. And like, as we get closer, it becomes apparent that there's another bull bugling, say maybe a few hundred yards behind him. So they're like fairly close proximity to each other. And we're just all the time, this bull's bugling every 30 seconds to a minute. So like pretty often. So we just shut up, get the wind right. And I just start cooking in. And we get tight, we're probably within 100 yards, and it's pretty thick aspen where we're at. This bull's still bugling. And so I just leave my dad and I start heading in, sneaking in. And I'm close, like damn close, like 20, 30 yards from these elk. Like you're moving, like through the bull screaming and everything. And finally, like through the aspens, I get this little hole, like a basketball size hole. And I can see a cow's head in it. And I'm like, okay, they're right there. And I'm like glassing. And I, behind her, I can see like maybe like a foot and a half of beam and like his third point sticking out. And I'm like, okay, I'm like, it's a mature bull. I don't know what he is, but like he's mature at least. So I'm like, you know, messing around in this hole, like trying to get a shot on him. He's like kind of moving back and forth. And I just can't find an opening to get an arrow through. And like the whole hunt, kind of like our go-to plan was, we got a bull bugling, we'd get in fairly tight, and I'd get like 50, 60 yards ahead of my dad. We'd kind of, you know, move in as a unit, if you will. But eventually, like I'm holed up in this spot for so long, I turn around, like my dad's like 10 yards behind me, like he's caught up now. Right. And I'm like, he's right here. And I'm like, so it's like, if you can imagine, it's like this big, like kind of just like circular area of this crazy thick aspen brush. And like, I'm on the edge of it. And I'm like, I'm just going to like try to sneak up and around it and just see, like, there's gotta be a hole somewhere. And so like, I dump my pack, my dad crawls up to that, and I start taking off. And like, you know, I can tell I'm close, like I'm real close. Like, so I can hear things, see things every once in a while. And like, finally I find this trail that like goes down in the middle of this thing. So I'm like on my butt with my bow in front of me and just like kind of scooting down this trail. I got like one cow at like 10 yards feeding. There's another one like a few yards behind her feeding. So I let them pass. This whole time, like I'm within 20 yards of this bull for probably like 10 minutes. And like, he's just screaming. And like, at this point, like, I can't see him. Like, he's right in front of me, but I know he's there, but right. I can't see him. And there's like this downfall log I have to climb up and over. So I like scoop my butt up on it. And like, once I get to the high point, all of a sudden I can see his beams right in front of me. He's bedded now right in front of me. And I could like just see like the top of it and like kind of the outline of the frame. But I'm like, okay, like he's a narrow, tall bull, but like he's got mass, he's heavy. Mm-hmm. And like, I remember like distinctly at one point, like crawling in, like I knew he was mature, and I knew like at one point, like as I'm crawling in, this is before I spotted him the second time, where I was like I'm gonna get a shot on this bull, and I know that I'm supposed to kill this bull. And I felt at ease of like not really knowing what he was. I just like, I was working so good that I was like, I know like this is what I was supposed to do. And so like, yeah, anyways, I come up over this log and I see him bedded right in front of me. He's like 15 yards now. And I'm like, okay. So I like get down and I'm like just like trying to scoot around this bush to get like kind of in position to where like if he gets up or whatever, I'm set. And I catch something kind of move, and I look over to right, and there's a cow like at like 5 feet, and she just turned her head and she's looking at me bedded like right freaking there. And one thing I forgot to mention, the wind's like blowing pretty good. So I think that's why I was able to get in so tight on these things. I mean, like you couldn't hear me move at all. So anyways, this cow jumps up immediately, and the bull kind of whips his head and he's looking, and like, you know, things are about to go down. It's about to blow up. Mm-hmm. So I just hook my release on and I'm waiting, and the bull jumps up and he runs and maybe, I don't know, 5 or 10 steps, and he stops. And I draw back and like, I can't see anything. So I'm on my butt and I'm like kind of hopping down the trail, like just trying to get an opening. Really? And finally I lean out and I could just see behind his shoulder. He's quartering away. Just see behind him. He's like 20 yards. I just buried the pin and, you know, shoot. And like, it sounds good, but like immediately he's gone. It's just, you know, can't see nothing. They're just totally out of sight, totally gone. I thought I heard a crash, but I wasn't sure, cause there's still some elk like kind of milling right around us, you know, so everything blows out of there. And like, you know, I start crying and shit, you know, losing my mind. And, so like I climb back over to my dad. I set my bow where I shot from, and I climb back over to my dad. He's like 20 yards away, but just on the other side of this brush pile. And I climb back over there and he looks at me and he's like, what are you doing? Where's your bow? And I'm like, what do you mean? Like, I think I got him. And he's like, you shot? And like, I'm like, yeah, I just shot him. Like, yeah, no idea. You couldn't even hear the shot at all. Like, yeah. I have no idea what happened. You know, so yeah, we gave him, you know, whatever, an hour. Like, I didn't know exactly where I hit, but like, I felt really confident about it. And yeah, started following blood trail. We had blood immediately, but it like, I mean, we had 2 or 3 spots and it disappeared. And like, we're following tracks. And I mean, you've been there on blood trails, you know, where you're like, you don't have blood and you're just like, oh my goodness, like what is going
course.
on? So like, oh dude, so like we're following tracks and like can't figure this out, not finding any more blood, and there's like a huge meadow in front of us, and like, you know, we would have seen him or something. Can't find anything. So like I just take a moment, leave my dad down there, and I like head back to like our last blood spot, and I'm just like kind of standing there, and I notice like one scuff mark in the dirt, like going a different direction. And I'm like, ah, whatever, I'll check that out. And it's an elk track, so I follow it like two or three steps, stand up on a log, and I can see his beam, you know, sticking up. He ran, it was like maybe 150 yards and he died. I ended up, the arrow went in like mid body up and down, right behind the last rib, and then came out like through the shoulder. You know, so it ended up as more like liver, single lung kind of a hit. He was pretty quartered. But yeah, like I said, he only went about 150 yards. He died in a picture perfect, like right on the edge of the aspen, like the thick stuff, but like died in the open stuff. You know, so it was
Nice.
like looking back on it, like I said, I had so much pressure on myself for this time. I was like, you know, I got to kill a bull, you know, above this, and you know, I need to have it called in, and I want to kill it at 20 yards. I always felt like a money shot, you know, whatever. Like I had all of these things, and like in reflection on the hunt, like I didn't kill the bull necessarily how I wanted to, but like all of the check marks that I had or check boxes that I had for this hunt, like got checked off at the end of it. Like I got every experience I wanted out of this hunt, and like ultimately I wanted the biggest bull I've ever killed, and like he might be there. He's pretty much like tied with like my best bull I've ever killed. But like ultimately at the end of the day, like the score didn't like mean anything. Like I just like I was upset that I put so much emphasis on that at the beginning of the hunt to myself. You know, but like at the end of it was just like the experience of it was so rewarding, and like just like the hunt itself was so good that like I didn't care.
Can I take you back to, so you said you had a moment where you missed a bull, you went back to the trailer, you know, you were throwing a little pity party for yourself. I've been there, certainly I've done it. I'm curious, what was your dad's reaction? Was he like classic dad mode in that scenario? Was he giving you pep talks?
Yeah, he was. He like he understood it. Like he knew where I was coming from. You know, he's been there before. But like my dad's like a very like just black and white guy. Like he's just like, okay, like here's the situation, here's how we're gonna change. Like he looks at things like that, and
Yeah, which is sometimes that's what you need, right?
yeah, totally. And like my
Especially a
brain like
situation like
overthinks
that.
it. Yeah, totally. Well, and that's like one thing I tell all the time. Like at the end of the day, like it's so easy to put elk on a pedestal, but like they're animals at the end of the day, pretty simple needs, and like it's so easy to overthink that situation. But yeah, I mean, I was definitely like, it was like a woe is me situation. You know, like, man, why do I deserve this? You know, like I did all this shit. Like, you know, I've been busting my ass and like putting up my time. Like, I don't deserve this. You know, but at the end of the day, like it was a blessing. You know, because like I missed that bull. I could have killed that bull and not been happy, and you know, whatever about it. So like, yeah, I don't know exactly, I guess, like the train of thought where I got over it. I think it was just kind of a matter of like you're here now, this is the situation. Like you want to, you know, you want to curl up, or you know, you missed them. Let's go try it again.
Yeah, those are the times, man, where it's like you're trying to figure out on your own. And I've been there. I was just there last year, so I had a hunt in Colorado. I hit a bull, and you know, not lethally, shoulder shot, you know, 26 inches of a 29 inch arrow hanging out as he, you know, peeled off. It'd been, you know, a rough experience kind of up to that point, and you know, I was feeling really just down and out, same kind of deal. Hiked to the top of the ridge. That was like midday. I got to this top of this ridge, and it was like kind of getting evening. And I was just like, I just want distance from the camera guy. I just like want to be by myself for a minute. Like same thing. I'm cursing. I'm kicking dirt, rocks. I'm just pissed, right? And I'm down and out, and I'm low. And went to bed. You know, lay down in my bivvy, and I'm laying there. I'm trying to decide like, what do I do? Like, do I keep hunting? Do I go home? And like every part of me was just like, you know what? This just like was not meant to be. Like, you should go home, you know, just go home, like wrap it, right? And I don't have like very many like close personal friends, like really not anybody for, you know, front of my mind where I was like, oh, I need to call this person. But like I just kept thinking like I should call my dad, and I don't talk to my dad all that often. Like I should talk to my dad way more than I do. But in that moment, I was like, it's pretty clear. Like, I need to call my dad. And I remember I called my dad and it was late. You know, he was in bed, wasn't feeling well. He had some back surgeries and some things going on, health issues, same kind of deal. I gave him the whole scenario and, you know, kind of similar to your dad. Like, you just sat and listened. He just like listened to me, you know, go on and on. And then at the end of it, he was kind of like, you know, what do you think? And I was just like, I don't know. I just want to be done. Like, I want to go home. And he was just like, well, you know, is that going to fix it for you? Like, you at home, like, is it going to make you feel better? I was like, you know, no, I'm going to be mad. I'll be madder because I gave up on it. And he's like, you should stay. He's like, you should stay and hunt. You should stay and keep hunting. He was like, you know, very clear, like asked very detailed questions about the experience and was like, is that bull, you know, did you mortally wound that bull? And I'm like, no. You know, and he's like, well, I think you should, but I did, the point being, like, he just had a very matter of fact point to me that stuck with me for a long time. And like, is your dad, I'm a dad, same kind of deal. I think those are the kinds of talks sometimes that only your dad can give you, right? And only your dad in that situation can be the person that can like give you the best advice and really lean into it. So I was curious as to your dad's reaction to that. Like, because even though you're a grown man now and you've got kids of your own, you know, my kids are getting older. I got a 20-year-old. You know, I'm in my 40s. My dad's never stopped being a dad. Like, when I've needed him, he's like, I'm going to give it to you straight, just like I always would as your dad.
Yeah, totally. And it's like, it's such a weird concept to me, just like growing old and like, you know, how you viewed your parents and like now, like, you know, you're their age when you were starting to think those thoughts of that. Like, it's just, it's interesting. But yeah, I mean, you know, that's one thing that like, I really enjoy about hunts now is like, I do a lot of solo hunts myself and like the mental aspect is like the biggest part of the entire thing. And like, I'm a firm believer, especially when it comes to elk, that like, persistence kills elk. Like, if you stay after it and stay after it and stay after it, like, that'll trump skill to some extent. You know, so like, as I've gotten older, and I think just more like open to the thoughts of life, like, just like, there's so many good lessons that come from like really shitty, challenging hunts. And like, and then like just the clarity on like family, you know, like for you having, you know, the you know, not to call your dad, or just like, you know, how much you appreciate your family, you know, that much more when you're getting your ass just handed to you.
Yeah, for sure. I'm glad you got to spend the time with your dad. That's really cool.
I think
that's neat.
Yeah, I think, it was a special hunt. And like, you know, looking back on it, it gets that much cooler, you know, as we get to kind of go on and like, just, you know, thinking about what we got to do together. And like I said, I mean, that really was, it was like the crowning jewel of like all elk hunting that we've had together. I mean, I started bow hunting with him when I was like 6 or 7. And like, I seen things like growing up as a kid that like a lot of grown men won't ever experience, like in the elk woods. And like, you know, like all that was because like he toted a 7-year-old around with him, you know? And so, yeah, getting that to come full circle. And like, I know like him getting to watch me do those things, you know, things that he's taught me to do. Like, I know like he was stoked on it.
Yeah. Like the last bow hunt I really shared, I mean, I shared a few others, but the last one that I was able to go with my dad, where his health was good. You know, we I'd drawn an elk tag in Utah and we went together. He had a tag as well, but I killed a good bull and it was a really hard hunt. And it was like day 14 or something that I killed this bull. He's a good bull. He's out here on my ping pong table, but, like the actual shot, the hunt itself, like I remember it, but the things I remember the most are just like conversations with my dad, like moments with my dad. Like my dad, he's funny. I remember multiple days, you know, we would hit a creek like midday, a creek crossing, and he'd be like, hey, let's like peel off and like take a bath, you know, in the creek. Like he would, you know, take his, you know, his feet and dump them in the creek and like wash his feet real good. You know, he'd lay down in it, kind of bathe, you know, like,
yeah,
just like little things like that, you know. And he would tell me stories about him backpacking when he was a younger man. And, you know, just like, that's the thing that I think about. Like, I remember the moment that I killed that bull. He was off my right shoulder and we watched this bull step out and his front leg went forward. And I remember him whispering like in my ear, like, hey, there's your shot. And kind of coached me through the whole process and ended up killing that bull. But like the actual rack itself, the animal itself, I mean, it's cool. But like it's like you're saying, those memories have become infinitely more valuable to me over the years.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. And we had like, yeah, cool little like, you know, encounters and things like that that happened on this hunt that like kind of made it. Like there was one thing, my dad several years ago gave me a hunting knife that was my grandpa's. He died when I was three. So like, I never really knew him, but like him and my dad were tight. Like, you know, they hunted a lot. And my dad gave me this knife a few years ago. And like, I just carry it in my pack. It's heavy as hell. It's like a double tang, like old, it's called a crown, heavier than hell, but like, I just carry it to carry it. And like, we get done taking pictures of the bull. I open up my kill kit and dude, I've got like 30 Havilon blades in there and no Havilon. I don't have a knife. And I'm like, oh my goodness. And all I have is my grandpa's old knife. And it's like, it's pretty dull, but like, it's what we have. And like, we made it work. And at the end of the day, like getting to cut up like my bull with my grandpa's knife, you know, and like, my dad had a little private moment, like with the knife after that, like, I just let him do his thing, you know? And like, it was just like, like I saw him in a moment there that was like, it wasn't dad. Like, it was like, you know, just a guy missing his dad or whatever. And it was just like,
yeah,
it was interesting and cool. And like, those are the little nuggets that like, I'll remember most.
For sure. Yeah, that's awesome. I'm glad you shared that. That was really cool. My advice would be to you, and not that I'm anybody to give advice, but I wish I had taken more detailed notes. Like I wish I would have written a lot of this down. Just like those little things, the stories that he shared, the moments that we had together and stuff. I wish I had written more of it down just so that I could like really retain it and go back and read it and then share it with my kids, you know?
Yeah, so, totally.
Yeah, that'd be my advice. Cause I think it might seem like, you know, I don't know how much I'd go back and read it, but I promise you'd have moments in the future, especially as time goes on, where it becomes just way more valuable to you. You just want to go back and reach into that bag and like recall a memory more vividly, you know?
Totally. Totally.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, congrats, man. I think it's awesome. I was super stoked for you. I remember, you know, seeing the photo and thinking, man, that's so cool. I'm glad Dave got out and got one done.
Yeah, man. Yeah, it was awesome. Like I said, at the end of the day, you know, the hunt, you know, it might have ended up a little bit different than I was expecting, but we got everything we wanted, you know, but it was a very fulfilling hunt.
Yeah. That's cool. Any, I was going to ask you some gear related questions at the end, but I already found out that you forgot a knife and you forgot a baton screw.
Right.
But you made do, right? Which is,
right.
I think that's the point of it. Like just because you might forget something or something doesn't go right, doesn't mean the whole sky is falling right. You just kind of adapt and move forward. But
totally.
What did you shoot for a setup as far as your bow goes?
Yeah, so I'm actually still rocking a Matthews V3. That bow, like, it just fits like an extension for me, and just I love the way that bow shoots. So like, I've shot that for years. I like back when I used to work in pro shops. Like I mean, I'd have like multiple bows a year, and like I was changing setups all the time. But like I've like found like since I've kind of gotten away from that scene, like I just kind of prefer what works for me and I just stick with that. So like, I'm running like a Hamsky Hybrid Hunter Pro for the rest, Spot Hog Fast Eddy on the site. Like, you know, it's pretty standard stuff. I got a shorter draw length, 27.5-inch draw length. So I'm never shooting like real fast on anything, but I was shooting double tip, Kinetic Chaos 340s with BPA, solid three blades. So I usually, most of my arrow setups, I usually come in 450 to 460. These are around, I think 452 finished. Mm-hmm. You know, but yeah, full pass through on that bull quartering away. You know, the arrow did excellent on him.
Gotcha. What broadheads did you say you shot?
I'm shooting the VPAs, the vantage points, and it's a solid three blade. Okay. So it's an unvented three blade, similar to like a Montex style, solid machined head, very quiet. Mm-hmm. Honestly, the quietest broadhead I've ever shot on the fixed blade. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're super quiet.
Gotcha. Interesting. Are you a solid guy then over mechanical?
Yeah, I always have been, not to the extent that like I'm like an anti-mechanical guy. I do like mechanicals and I've killed stuff with them. I think that they have their place for sure. I think my biggest gripe with mechanicals is guys switching to mechanicals because their fixed blades aren't flying, you know, and then not doing the tuning to still get the efficiency out of that mechanical too. But I definitely carry them. There's situations where I like them.
Gotcha. Very cool. What'd you shoot for a release?
Shooting a Wise Choice three finger.
Okay. Got you. Yeah. The old wrist strap.
Yeah. I've been a big fan of that thing.
Yeah, I know. And if you could shoot them well, shoot them. Cause they're, I mean, I've said it probably, I don't know, many times. It's like, it's certainly more effective in a hunting situation if you can do it and do it well. Mm-hmm. And then there's some people that are head cases like me. I just can't do it. I fall apart. So yeah. It's like I gotta have some means of slowing me down.
Totally. Yeah, I think that's the big thing in archery is like finding the stuff that like you yourself are confident in. I mean, you look at broadheads. Like I used to shoot slick tricks, and I've killed a lot of animals with slick tricks. And like you know, back in the day in the shop, like I'd recommend slick tricks to somebody, and they'd be like, "Oh, you know, I shot those and didn't get anything for blood trails." You know, like, you know, I did, but like that guy didn't have a good experience. Like, you don't want to shoot that head that, you know, you have a doubt on at full draw. You know, I think ultimately, yeah, it's just finding the stuff that works good for you. And I think that's kind of the same with your hunting tactics too. You know, instead of trying to like adapt to the area that you're hunting, figure out how you can hunt it, you know, how you know how to hunt it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Completely concur, you know, find out what works best for you, and everybody's different, right? Like everybody mm-hmm. has different physical abilities and limitations. Everybody's mental capacity is different. You know, the way they execute shot is different. You know, the way they feel comfortable hunting is different. Some people are really patient. Some people aren't. They want to run and gun. You know, some people are more, I like you. So we talked about it a little earlier, but I like, mm-hmm. I generally like units or areas like where I feel like I can outwork somebody else. Like I can go further. I can stay out longer. I can live off my back, you know? And that's, but in saying that, there's areas that aren't conducive to it. So there's like, I gotta try to learn to figure that out, which is one of my goals for the next couple of years is like, I gotta figure out how to be a little bit more productive when the pressure is a little bit higher and I can't quite get the space, even though the elk are there, you know?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, I appreciate talking to us, Dave. You're a good dude. I always enjoy visiting with you. Anything else you wanted to touch on before I cut you loose? I've had you for an hour.
Yeah, I think that's it, man. I had a good time chatting with you on this.
Yeah, thanks for jumping on at late notice. I think I just hit you up like yesterday, probably, or the day before. So
yeah, always down to talk elk.
Yeah, agreed, man. Anything coming up in terms of draws or changes this year that you guys are kind of aware of?
Nothing too crazy outside of like what you hit on. I mean, the big one going in this year is going to be that the change in Idaho, you know, coming up, and just kind of see how that's going to play out. I'm kind of a fan of it just because I hated dealing with the stress of the old system. Yeah, I'd kind of just rather leave it up to chance. I'm honestly more excited about the aspect of, you know, being able to do hunts with friends now in Idaho. It's been so hard to try to line up, you know, same tag in the same area with somebody else lately.
Let me ask you a burning question that I've had in regards to this. So you get five choices. That's my understanding, right? And my understanding is that they're going to take everybody's first choice into account before they move to anybody's second, third, fourth, fifth choice, right? So in essence, if you draw a tag as a second choice, it would mean that there were remaining permits after every applicant's first choice was considered.
Correct.
Okay. What does that do to your strategy as far as like, do you know what I mean?
I don't know. Yeah. Cause you if you think about it, like you could have like, hypothetically, you could have like decent tags that, you know, make it to a second choice just based on, you know, if everybody throws in for Diamond Creek as a first choice,
yeah,
you know, you might have like, you're the outlier that throws, you know, Pioneer or Salmon or something like, you know, I think that like, I think it's going to be interesting because it's going to add value to like mid-tier units and even some low-level units. Like there's going to be opportunity, I think, to start sussing out hunts that, you know, fly under the radar. But like if you learn them and you can get that tag often enough, you're going to figure it out.
That's where my head went. Same thing. Although I would love a, you know, Pioneer or a Diamond Creek tag. In the back of my mind, I'm going, everybody would love that. They're probably going to put it as their first choice.
Right.
You know, maybe I'm going to slide over and put, you know, South Hills or, you know, Big Desert or something like that. And essentially, if I did that, I think I'd almost, it's hard to say, but there's probably a much better likelihood that I would draw that as a first choice.
I almost think in a sense that, yeah, this draw system, it's going to create like more opportunity for like hidden gems in a sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you know if they'll publish odds? Like, or will we be able to cover odds? Will they give us
that? Yeah. I'm hoping we'll be able to get that. Yeah. I'm curious just to see like how it all looks, you know, and like kind of how that plays out. But yeah, I definitely, that's the plan.
Yeah. Well, interesting. Yeah, I'll have to dig deep and see what I end up coming up with, but
right.
That'll be neat. It's fast. It's like not all that far out.
No, I know. Yeah. You're like just getting done with stuff and having to restart.
I know. All right, man. Well, I'll cut you loose. Thanks, Dave. I appreciate it, man. I hope you have a good rest of your day. Congrats again. That was super cool. I was stoked for you. So, you know, good job. And I guess on to the next. Thank you.